This is Amelia Bunder, Oral History Chairperson for the Pittsburgh Unit Women's Overseas Service League. Today I am interviewing Theodora Smolinski, a member of the Pittsburgh Unit for a great many years. Theodora, what did you think when I selected you to be one of the participants for Oral Histories?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I don't think about the Army except somebody calls it to my attention. It's just part of my past, I guess.
Okay. Well, let's start with the questions. Now, what branch of service did you serve?
I was with the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps for about 10 months. And then I joined the Women's Army Corps and was a member for 26 months. 3 years altogether.
Oh, that, well, you had an extended tour of duty. Where did you serve? Where did you?
Daytona Beach, Florida, Maxwell Field, Alabama, Tidworth, England, Salisbury, England, and Paris, France.
How long was your, well, where did you have basic training? Where did you?
Daytona Beach.
Oh, that was your area of basic training. And now you mentioned your overseas assignment. How long were you stationed overseas?
About 18 months.
Well, you did have an interesting experience. What influenced you to volunteer for the military service?
Well, I was felt that I, as an ex-Canadian, needed to help America win the war. And I also, there was also a big push to keep a father at home. And by the time I joined, the one person I knew who was a father was already in the service. So I didn't help him.
Well, when you say an ex-Canadian, what do you mean by that?
I was born in Canada.
I see. And then when did you come to the United States?
When I was about 3 in 1922.
Oh. So you considered yourself an American?
Definitely.
Yes. And, were you the only member of the family to be involved in military service?
My brother was in the Merchant Marine, and my sister was an Army wife.
Oh, well, so you had more support in the family. Mm-hmm. What were you doing prior to your enlistment? And let us know when you actually did enlist. What was the date of your enlistment?
I was a stenographer and switchboard operator.
And where was that at?
Pittsburgh, for Liberty Mutual Insurance Company.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I joined, October 21st, 1942.
When you apparently your reason for joining the service seemed to be principally patriotic.
Yes.
Did you expect, you know, your military service to offer you and to achieve any other purpose, or was
no.
You hadn't really given that a thought
no.
At the time that you would you say that it did? Now in retrospect.
Well, I don't think it did, except that under the GI Bill, I went to school to become an occupational therapist, and I guess that's the influence of the Army.
Yes, and that was a very critical one.
I saw occupational therapy at work in the Army hospitals, and so I, where I did volunteer work in Paris, and I knew that the activity could help people a lot.
Well, you said volunteer work. You mean in addition to your military experience, you were working as a volunteer?
We worked 6 days a week. No, 7 days a week, 6 hours a day on the switchboard in Paris. And that gave you 18 hours a day to fill with something, and I didn't drink, so I had to find something to do. So I went to the Red Cross and volunteered.
And what was the nature of that activity?
Well, at first I was to write letters, help GIs who couldn't write letters to their wives. And it got to the place where I could not look at the men and say, "Oh, your husband is fine." So then I went back to the Red Cross and asked for a different assignment, and they assigned me to an arts and crafts area, which I knew about.
Yes, and that's subsequently led to your choice of occupational therapy as your professional role in the future.
Yes.
That's very interesting, Theodora. That really is unusual. Here you were, it really involved in two great aspects. That's now you mentioned that the nature, you were an operator, a telephone operator. Was that essentially the nature of your work throughout your military experience, both stateside and overseas?
No, stateside, I was a secretary or a company clerk or something like that. But overseas, they needed switchboard operators, and I volunteered. And when they asked for volunteers, and the sergeant said, "You're not supposed to volunteer." I said, "Oh, I like it." So I did it.
So
I was on a small switchboard in southern England, and then I moved from there to the next, was Paris Military, the largest military switchboard. And
Well, you must have had some very interesting things probably come over the telephone, maybe not even, I don't know whether personally, but maybe with the group involved, I guess.
Well, we didn't have time to find out what was on the telephone.
I see.
Just before we left, we called San Francisco, and we could hear them, but they couldn't hear us because the lines in Paris were so, needed repaired so badly.
So you couldn't make the connection. So let's talk a little bit about the housing and some of the more concrete things that are pertinent to the military service. Do you recall what your pay was and your rank? How did you move up in
there? Well, as a private, I got $21 a month, and about 4 or 6 months later, within 6 months anyway, I started earning $50 as a private. And then as I went up in rank, I got more, but I haven't any idea how much more. I was a sergeant when I came out of the Army.
Now, did they have male soldiers in doing that, carrying out that particular type of work, or were you all women? As operators?
In England, it depended on the the type of army installation you were in. There were a lot of girls doing switchboard, but there were a lot of men doing it too.
Now, when you say the type, you mean like closer to an area that might be more critical in terms of fire?
In London, the switchboard was the fourth story underneath the building.
Wow.
And those were a mixture of boys and girls, men and women. And then in Tidworth, we had a switchboard inside one of the men's barracks, and every day I would hear about those terrible whacks that went up into the men's barracks, and I couldn't believe it because we were all so busy, and I discovered it was me they were talking about. But they didn't know that the end of the barracks was separated.
You mentioned four stories. Was that a bomb shelter?
It was underneath a store, like a parking, probably would have been a parking garage, but then was made into a switchboard operating.
That's really very interesting. About the pay and the nature of the assignment, but what about the housing and the medical attention? Did you find any discrepancies in terms of what was afforded to you versus what would have been afforded to the male soldier?
No. Mm-mm. We got the same.
Were you housed in the same areas, or did they have separate areas for the female military?
We were sort of separated, but not Now, in Paris, we had a whole hotel for wax only. But men could come and go first floor.
Yes.
But I don't know there.
But you weren't housed together.
No.
Yeah,
no.
Yes. I think that was the pattern. I think, generally speaking, women were housed separately.
Separately.
But as you said, though, they had access to the to the lobby or the living room or whatever the guest areas would be in these facilities. What about your dress, your uniform dress? Do you recall what you began with versus any changes that may have occurred throughout your life?
No, I don't think so.
Did you get suited? Were you in ODs when you went into the service?
No, we had the khaki when we were in Florida and Alabama. Then when we went overseas, we got ODs and Eisenhower jackets and slacks.
Well, you know, the nurses started in navy blue. You know, the nurses who went into the service earlier during in the World War II started with the color navy blue uniform, and then subsequently that was changed. And I wondered if that was true of but apparently...
I tried to get into the Navy because their uniforms were blue and I have blue eyes. But they wouldn't take me because I had glasses.
That's a very interesting reason for selection of service.
How do you know what you're doing? Patriotic is patriotic.
Right, but you did want something to match your blue eyes.
Can't stand brown.
What would you say were some of your memorable experiences in terms of your military? What was it? The entry into the service, the different type of lifestyle, or did you happen to have any unusual experiences as part of your...
I think crossing the ocean on the Queen Mary was about the nicest thing, except that it took us 12 days, and we were one day we would be in the North Atlantic and the next in the South Atlantic.
Yes.
And we had English rations, two meals a day, and in the morning you had lamb and potatoes, but at nighttime you had potatoes and lamb, and it worked out all right. Of course, I don't mind eating, so it's all right, as long as they feed me.
How many were on the ship, on the Queen Mary, when you went overseas?
I have no idea, but there were 500 WACs, but there were a lot of GIs.
Yes.
We had a lot of churches. I went to every church service, no matter what denomination, because we had 40 girls in a stateroom, probably 30 of which were sick.
Yes.
And so I got out of there every time.
As I recall my experience.
Then coming back, we were on the Ile-de-France, and we had American rations. And we ate with the officers, so we got all kinds of fancy food. And the waiters always made sure we had something for our third meal. Of course, I never don't remember anybody ever getting it back because the GIs were still eating K rations, and they needed it more than we did.
Yes, yes. Did you, were you surprised at meeting people, or maybe you've had more exposure, but were you surprised at meeting the different people from all parts of the country, and did that have any significance for you?
I don't think that bothered me at all.
Well, I don't mean so much bothered, but I mean, were you impressed
I don't know. Part of it was when I'm in the Tidworth switchboard, we weren't allowed to use our names.
Well, what did you have, a number, or how did?
I was called Penny from Pennsylvania, and somebody else would be called
Was that considered a code name? A Penny, was that considered a code name, or
just a name among the operators?
A nickname. Not official. Just a nickname.
There were a lot of things that were official on the switchboard.
Yes.
But but...
Well, now, were you... Now, you mentioned your nickname being Penny because you were from Pennsylvania. Were you... When you went into the service, did you go alone, or were there some other people that accompanied you, or did you meet a group from Pennsylvania, or what the...
The girls that I went in with, October,
yes,
were in the Army in November, but somehow or other they couldn't believe that I was an American. They thought I must still be Canadian because it wasn't on my mother's naturalization. So I had to prove to them. So yes. The next group came and I was still ready. I was ready to go. And they still weren't ready for me to
I
go.
See.
So
because of your verification, of your naturalization.
And there was a short period when children were not put on the naturalization.
Yes.
Of course, that would be when I was there.
Yes, it happened to affect your mother's papers.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So then but actually when you went into the service, you went alone. You didn't go with a friend or something like this, and then whatever group you came in contact with.
They were always new.
Yeah. Did you like England?
I liked England, yes, very much. It was sort of a soft atmosphere, soft country, and the people were nice.
Yes. Was this part of England that you were in, was that part of the area that was bombed by the Germans?
No, because they couldn't find above the Tidworth area. It looked like a big lake from a plane up above, and people coming back from France would realize when they got across this lake that this was Tidworth, but people from Europe, from the Germans, they didn't know what was down there.
I see, so they weren't really aware that was because it seemed to be camouflaged.
Yes.
That's very interesting.
That was a natural camouflage.
Yes.
But I've been on trains that were bombed, and I've been in, as I say, in the when I was in the switchboard, four stories down, there was a time when there was a bomb and all the lights came on, and even I, who was visiting, sat and said, "Are you there?" And if they weren't there, we'd plug it up so that we wouldn't have to answer that again, because the telephones had all been jiggled off their hooks.
I see. Yes.
But
What did you think of Paris? You mentioned part of your experience included an assignment in Paris.
I didn't think much of Paris. It's a beautiful city, but I wasn't very happy. I wasn't simpatico, I guess, with them as I was with the English.
Do you think that because of the language barrier?
I think the language. I have a real problem with that.
With French? With
not being able to understand people.
I see.
It doesn't matter. Even as an occupational therapist,
I
still run into this same business. I can't understand what the patient is saying, and it's hard. But coming from England to Paris, I was in a convoy, and the boat in front of us was hit by a mine.
Oh.
And the convoy immediately disbanded, and we were in the middle of this of no place.
Yes.
And then when we got to the shore, we had to wait. We couldn't get off right away, and the people who were getting off, being disembarked, were the people who had been in the boat that was hit. They had been picked up by a destroyer and brought in, and they came in just before us.
Well, that had to be a frightening moment.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
But the worst part was the GI cans full of spaghetti, which had been sitting around since supper time. This was 4 a.m. You can see I'm food oriented.
Oh, that's a serious moment, but it does have a light little bit attached to it.
You need to have a sense of humor.
Yes, you do. You really do. Yes, otherwise it was. Were there any other parts of your experience what would you say stands out the most in terms of your military experience? If someone asked you what was the singular thing about it that had either meaning or remembrance, what would you say?
Gee, I wouldn't have any idea what that would be. Uh-huh. The whole business was
the whole, yes.
3 years of new things every day.
Yes. Would you repeat it if the opportunity presented itself, of course, you know, say at that same age, in retrospect, would you?
Oh, I think, yes. I didn't go from Paris to Czechoslovakia, which I was offered an opportunity to go and teach girls to operate Army switchboard, but I decided I wanted to come home then.
I said you were homesick.
I guess.
Yes. So, but one of the questions suggested is, can you compare service careers, you know, with the present? Now, actually, you had moved into a new field.
Well, it's pretty hard, except that you still had to get up and go to work every day, and I had to go to work every day at home.
Yes.
Because being just post-depression, you didn't have a chance to stay home and not do anything.
So you mean you got a job as soon as you came back from the service?
Oh, yes. I went back to the job I had before I went in.
Yes.
And they had me as a switchboard operator, but they didn't need one because I'd been replaced there, so they put me on the billing machine. And I wasn't very good at that. But since I was going to OT school and very shortly, they kept me on anyway.
That was good. Yeah. So then how long did you remain at that job?
About 9 months, I guess. I came home probably the end of October and went to school in September.
I see. And then you made use of some part of your GI Bill.
Yeah.
That was the educational. Mm-hmm. And was that going to a university?
University of Pennsylvania, but it was called Philadelphia School of Occupational Therapy.
I see. And how long did you attend?
3 years.
3 years.
Mm-hmm. So, I got a diploma, not a college
degree. I see. And that gave you the. Then you became an occupational therapist on a basis of this 3 years of. Did you use any of the other benefits available under the GI Bill, such as housing?
No.
Or no, that was the only one. Just the educational benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Theodora, what area of your military experience would you say demanded the most adjustments?
Well, I don't know about that. I did what I was told and let it go at that. I'll have to admit that I used to keep my footlocker in apple pie order, and when they were going to be inspected, they'd ask somebody else to fix theirs up, and that used to make me mad. But, it's just the same as at home. You have to go to work, and you have to learn the words that go with the place you're working. Come to terminology, just join the occupational therapist, and you'll know there's lots of different words. But I don't think I had really any trouble. I was pretty much a loner, and if I wanted to do something, I did. I had friends, but I had more friends from away that would come to Paris. And then when I was at the, more than what do you want this now, when I was at the Red Cross, some young man came up to me and looked at me and he said, "You look like a sensible girl." And I thought, oh my. And he said, "Can you dance? Do you have to dance that way, the jitterbug?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I'll dance with you then." And I thought, well. So every time he had a buddy coming down to Paris, he would tell them to look me up if he thought they were fit for me to meet.
Oh, well, that was very good.
That was real nice. And a lot of fun going that way. ran a sightseeing, Paris sightseeing tour for everybody that came into town.
Well, that helped you to get better oriented to the city.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, did you find any regulation that was particularly annoying or unpopular for yourself or for the group in which you found yourself while you were in the service?
I don't know. I guess there were a lot of people who didn't like to keep on time, but that was not my problem. If they said such and such a time, mm-hmm. I was there. One time we were watching in the Louvre, looking at the Mona Lisa, I think, when I realized that I had a half an hour to inspection time. And as I got to the inspection place, my boyfriend shined my shoes and I pushed my hat on straight and fixed my hair and walked out just as the officer started walking in.
So you made it.
I made
it. So you made it. So. Well, in some areas, you know, there would be a curfew, you know, when you had to come in and so forth. Was that part of your experience at any point?
No, we lived through that sort of thing. In Paris, there were a lot of times when we weren't supposed to go out.
I see.
But
you were restricted.
We were restricted to our hotel.
But, yes.
It's like other things. You can always go to bed if you can't do anything else. And of course, when you walk to the seventh floor to go to bed, by that time you were pretty tired.
Well, then Paris was your last assignment, and when demobilization. That was the basis for your termination of military service. Mm-hmm. And then you returned to the States. Mm-hmm. And did you consider joining the reserves in any capacity after you came home for the military?
No way. Not patriotic enough for that.
Well, tell us some of the things that you did do after service. Now, we know that you took advantage of the GI Bill of Rights in the education. You went to school and you became an occupational therapist. What did that mean then in terms of ongoing employment?
I worked from then with long-term patients, tuberculosis patients, psychiatric patients.
And where was that? Why don't you mention the facilities that you worked?
Olean, New York is where there was a small private sanatorium that I worked in, and they were closed, so then I came back to the University of Pittsburgh, the psychiatric hospital, and then I worked for the City of Pittsburgh in the TB sanatorium. Then I worked for the State of Pennsylvania in the Dixmont State Hospital. Then I transferred to Polk State School, where I worked with retarded, and this is the first time I had really realized the needs of the retarded, and so I was very happy there.
How long did you work at Polk?
3 years, uh-huh. And then I came home to take care of my mother, who was 85 or so, and while I was home, I got a college degree, because at Polk, they kept saying, "She doesn't have a college degree. Let her teach that, or let her do that." And so I got a college degree.
So what was your degree and what was the nature of your degree?
Special studies, I think it's called.
Yes, uh-huh.
And then I went back to the psychiatric hospital so that I would be in Pittsburgh with my family.
Yes.
And then when that job terminated, I went to work at Torrance State Hospital with a retarded group up there, and then I retired.
Yes. Did you, when you think of your, do you think that being in the military enhanced your capacity to move into the professional role?
I don't know about that, but it helped me with the patients, because when I was having difficulties, I'd say, "Now you know, there's a sergeant in the army. When I say, goes." And the boys all thought that was pretty funny for a lady to be a sergeant.
And
as long as you could make it into a humorous time for everybody.
It was acceptable.
It was acceptable.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So actually, it did. Well, it did help you to prepare in working with others, mm-hmm. in, mm-hmm. to some extent. So.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then when I met an occasional French patient, then I could also have. Talk to them about what yes. I knew about their yes. country, which made them more home here.
Yes, more mm-hmm. comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, Theodora, I know you've been with the Women's Overseas Service League for well, practically ever since World War II, and you have been a very active member and involved in some unusual activities. Would you share some of those things with us now, please?
Well, one of the nicest things about being out of the Army was the Women's Overseas League. I met a lot of lovely people, and they were always trying to do things for other people, and that fit in with my way of thinking. And one of the projects which we have done for, at least 12 years anyway, is make Christmas presents for the transitional living service people.
Tell us what are the transitional living services? What does that mean?
Well, they take care of people who have been in the hospital for many years and are training them to live on their own in the community.
These are essentially people with psychiatric disorders, is that correct?
Psychiatric and mentally retarded.
Oh, both, I
yes.
see. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And the packages we make at Christmas is to help them who don't have enough smarts to manage to get along in the world, or maybe they don't they have enough smarts and they know better than to get along in the world. They stay where there's a protected environment and where there are people. One of the groups that I also work with, other than the Christmas presents, those are people who are in the transitional living services homes. The people who have graduated from TLS are in the community, and I have a group of about 12 of them who were friends with me at Polk and needed a friend in the community. And we have taken them from people who all sat around and everybody talked at once and nobody would listen to anybody else, to where we now can have a fairly normal conversation, and we can all, I can remember the day we first laughed at the same joke, there were 12 of us at that time, and all 12 laughed at the same joke, and this was a real big day for me. They used to have help at the end of the month with their food, but by now nobody has called me for over a year for money for food at the end of the month.
But they are living in a community arrangement.
They are living together in
yes.
a home.
Yes.
Not anybody else's home, but their home.
Yes.
And they have a garden. They have an older man there who seems to know about gardening, and so he's helping the boys to do the gardening, and they grow
yes.
and can food as if food was going out of style, and probably it is. Maybe that's the reason they don't call me. But when they have trouble with the law or with the dog catcher or something like that, they call me because I can guide them.
And advise them.
Yes.
Do they have any professional? Do they have any official supervision in this home?
Not in this home, no. They have a caseworker, I guess, with SSI. SSI.
Yes.
They have some kind, but they're on their own now.
Yes.
They work. There are four of them in one home, and they sell newspapers and if they two go out and do it, and yes. If the men can't go, the girls go, and
But originally, were these part of the transitional services
originally, then they were able to move into this independent.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were talking about the Christmas gifts for the transitional services, how many gifts would you say were acquired for distribution at that time?
We acquire about 175 at a value of $5 each.
That's a tremendous effort.
This is a year-long thing.
Yes.
I had showed somebody my room, my transitional room, and it looks full already. And this is only February.
And when you speak about these bags, what's in a bag on an average basis, would you say, for as a gift?
Toothpaste and toothbrush and soap and washcloths and something like jewelry or shampoo and maybe a flower arrangement or a pretty scarf or handkerchief. I'm already pricing handkerchiefs because I need one for each bag.
Yes.
And the value is about $5,
Is this met by the members of the Pittsburgh unit, or is any other group contributing to this particular project?
The church that I belong to contributes in that at rummage sales I can get anything I need free. The Women's Overseas League get together between 35 and 40 presents at the Christmas party, but in the meantime somebody else will leave 10 bars of soap on my front porch, and everybody knows that this is from somebody in WOSL. I try to stress to people to look for things that are inexpensive,
yes,
but that are pretty. You know,
yes.
Life is pretty dull if you don't have anything.
Well, essentially, though, it is a project of the Pittsburgh unit, but
yes,
you do have some,
yes,
you are getting some assistance from other groups. You're also involved with the Jubilee Kitchen, which is certainly receiving a lot of attention in the Pittsburgh area right now, and we are proud of your participation in this group. Do you want to spell that out a little for us?
Well, I work on Thursdays preparing soup, vegetables for tomorrow's soup, and serving today's soup, and salad if there is any, and donuts for dessert if there are any, or cake. And
now, where is the Jubilee Kitchen located in the Pittsburgh area?
Well, it's called Uptown. It's also called Soho. It used to be Soho. And it's, we have between 200 and 300 men a day.
Just men, or?
No, men and women,
yeah,
but more men than women. I don't know why that is, except that there are men, if a truck driver drives up the street and is hungry at noon and they're serving, he can come in. If the men who work in the area are hungry, they can come in, because nobody checks to see whether. But if you have 10 children and are a truck driver, you need a free meal the same as anybody else does. There is no problem for anybody in there. And you have as many bowls of soup as you want. And they aim to get meat into every soup, every kind of soup, and if they run out of soup, then they happen to have, you know, a case of cans of soup that they can pass out, and there are clothing can be given out there. I have contributed 15 blankets down there that go to people who need them. We have people who sleep under the bridges, and we have people who have small children and don't have enough blankets, and we have people who don't have heat, so that yes. there's always a need for warm clothing, underwear.
Who funds this project? Where is the source of money?
There is no real source of money. There is a Jubilee Association, which is comprised of the soup kitchen and a new project at the prisons where they're working with the families of the new prisoners, and a pantry for emergency food for people who who have a fire or for some reason lose their stamps. And the money comes from donations. Twice a year, I guess, they send out a letter. I don't get one of those, though, so yes. I don't know what yes,
I never have either. No. I have never gotten the letter from.
But twice a year they send out a letter, and that goes for, well, they always buy coffee. I mean, if they can't get coffee some other way, they do go out and buy it.
Yes.
They go to the Strip District, which in Pittsburgh is a wholesale house, wholesale area. And they buy a lot down there if they have to buy something. But also those people send a lot out to us.
How did you get involved with Jubilee Kitchen? Because that is not a Women's Overseas Service League project per se. How did you get involved with the...
One of the girls in the carpool that I was in when the last 4 years I worked talked about it. She was a... I guess you'd call it a gopher. If some restaurant had bread that was left over, they would call, and then she was one of the people who would make it her business to go and get them. And I thought maybe I could do that, but I'm really much better at scraping carrots and peeling onions.
Were you were involved with the Raggedy Ann and Andy project too, weren't you? That was a project at the Pittsburgh Unit for a good many years.
So yes. I was an expert at that, and every once in a while I look at all the boxes that I have that have Raggedy Ann things in, patterns in them. I think I should start that up again. That was a good money-making project.
That certainly was, and certainly a very interesting one.
Yeah.
And have you any idea how many Raggedy Ann and Andy dolls were made by the Pittsburgh unit over the period of time that this was a project?
Well, I would be tempted to say between 2,000 and 3,000. I know in one year alone I made 300 myself. And then the next year I sort of slacked off. I probably only made 200, and then we kept going down. So
that was a tremendous project, and of course the purpose of which was to make funds, you know, for...
I only made the bodies, though.
Yes,
we all
yes.
specialized
oh, yes.
in our
right.
little...
But still, that was a tremendous thing, you know, and I think everyone enjoyed it with the dolls.
They were so pretty to look at, too.
Yes. Let me ask one other question. Now, we were talking about some of your activities. I know also that you have been involved as an officer, and presently you are vice president. What other offices did you hold
I
since
have
you've
been everything except treasurer, I think. They don't trust me with their money. I spend it. I don't. I earn it and I spend it, but they don't.
That's probably because you resist that one. So, well, Theodora.
One other project, which I'm very proud of, though it's sort of quiet, is that we send $40 worth of seeds to Appalachia. And they, first time I sent them, they didn't know what to do with them, but now they have a volunteer who teaches people how to grow these seeds in the area where they are. I mean, if they're up on the mountainside and they have just a little bit of green, then they know what to, or a little bit of shade, no sun, why they know what to plant there.
For that particular climate. Where in Appalachia are these seeds being forwarded?
Kentucky.
Kentucky, mm-hmm. Yes. And that's become an annual project with the Pittsburgh Unit, Women's Overseas Service League.
Yes.
Well, Theodore, I thank you very much. It was it's been an interesting time here, getting your military experience and bringing us up to date with your volunteer activities. Thank you very much.